Insperity presents the Small Business Advocate Show with Jim Blasingame. This is a copyrighted production of Small Business Network, Inc., all rights reserved.
We're back. It's 12 after. I'm Jim Blasingame, the Small Business Advocate, 800-531-3815, toll-free coast to coast. I'm excited about our guest this hour. He's our good friend, longtime member of our Brain Trust. He's a member of the Fed, the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas. He's our friend, Dr. Robert McTeer. Bob, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Jim.
It's good to have you back.
Well, thank you. It's good to be back.
Okay, you just rotated off as a voting member of the FOMC, the Federal Open Market Committee. Does it make you sad when it would seem to me that, and as zealous as you are, as conscientious as you are, as hard as I know you work to make sure that you do a good job in those meetings, because I know how you are, I know how much you care about this economy and about what you do, is it hard to rotate off as a voting member?
Well, hard would be overstating it. You do everything the same way whether you're voting or not.
Right.
But I guess, you know, if I had my druthers, I'd rather be a voting member all the time.
I told you. Well, and you know, you do, it just, if you care about what you do, you want to be able to be in all the games, don't you? Put me in, coach. Okay, talk to us about the economy. And in an article you wrote that was published in the Wall Street Journal in January, you, and I'm going to talk about a couple of things in that article, but one of the things that you said was watch out for fourth quarter 2002.
Yeah, that article was about the phenomenal growth in labor productivity, output per hour worked, that we've had in the last few quarters. And in this past year, it's just been a record setter. It's unusual for that to happen in a fairly slow economy and a recession. But you know, the fourth quarter we knew was going to be very weak, and with that, we couldn't expect productivity to go up unless total employment went down.
Right. And, why was fourth quarter different from the other three?
Well, it was different mainly in the arithmetic. Grew at an annual rate of 4%, and the fourth quarter grew at an annual rate of 0.7%.
Uh-huh.
And so that made a big difference in the productivity numbers. For the last year, we've had a weak quarter, strong quarter, weak quarter, strong quarter, and we knew that the fourth was going to be weak. It's a sawtooth thing right now.
Yeah.
I think the quarter we're in, I wouldn't characterize it as going to be strong, but there'll be some rebounds in the fourth quarter.
Yeah. What are you seeing? What are we going to wind up with? Just under 3% for the year 2000 in growth? 2002?
I'm not sure it'll be under 3. It'll okay. Be right around 3, I think.
I predicted that 2003. You know me with my predictions. You know how dangerous I am. But although Bob, I will point. I'd like to point out that I was 12 for 16 in my 2002 predictions. But I predicted, one of the things I predicted for 2003 is that growth would be over 4% by the end of the year, quarter over quarter.
I don't think that would surprise me. It's a little on the high side of what everybody's projecting, but
when I went to the reasonable. I graduated from the Robert McTeer School of Optimism.
Yeah. Well, you have a better track record on this economy if you're an optimist all the time than if you're a pessimist all the time.
That's the first course we took, folks, when we went to the Robert McTeer School of Optimism.
I'm still thinking about that number for the year. You know, we had a 5% annual rate in the first quarter and a 4% in the third quarter. I think the second was 1.7, and the other one was 0.7. So it'll be right around 3, I think.
Yeah. How do we reconcile that kind of growth? People are hearing us talk about these kinds of numbers, Bob, and there's still a couple of million people unemployed. We've got, you know, when you and I, some of the things we first started talking about when you joined me on the show over 3 years ago was, or about 3 years ago, was that we had full employment. Anybody who wanted to work could work. We don't have that now, and yet the economy is still growing. How do we reconcile those two numbers?
Well, by just what we were just talking about, productivity has been fueling the growth this past year, not new jobs. we basically have had a jobless recovery so far.
You think it is official, don't and I agree with you.
Well, I mean, all you've got to do is measure the total employment at the beginning and the end, and they're roughly the same. And if productivity hadn't been so good, it'd probably been up a little bit. Productivity growth in the short run can take away from job growth. It's a good thing in the long run because it's increasing our standard of living. But right now, we need to be growing faster so that we can have the fast productivity growth as well as employment growth.
Do we have some alignment problems here in the United States with globalization, with some of the events of the latter part of the 20th century, with the dot-com issues and everything, with globalization, with the way technology is changing so many paradigms? Some industries are completely different. They've been turned on their ear over the last few years. Are we seeing a major alignment problem that's never really seen before in America right now with regard to putting people to work?
On that score, I'm sure it's temporary. We have imbalances in the economy that are either a problem now or a potential problem. For one thing, we've had good consumption growth for the last couple of years, but we've had virtually no business investment growth.
Mm-hmm.
This recession was a business investment recession.
Been going on for about 2 years, hasn't it?
Yeah. And so we don't have enough investment to go along with our consumption. We don't have enough profits either to incent business investment. And in terms of the international context, we're not exporting nearly as much as we're importing. We're getting away with that in the short run by running up debts and running off assets internationally, but that can't go on forever. So we would have a healthier economy if all those imbalances were redressed, and they will be. The market mechanism tends to work, and the churn tends to work, but it's sometimes painful.
But aren't we all? I mean, the Fed, the U.S. government, other governments, and Joe and Jane, public, you know, just private citizen, aren't we all experiencing some dynamics that we've really never had before in terms of? It just seems to me that we're facing some new challenges that we've never had before, including the Federal Reserve Board. When we come back, I want to get you to comment on that right after these messages. It's 20 after. We'll be right back with our good friend, Dr. Robert McTeer, the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas. We're back. It's 23 after. 800-531-3815. Toll-free coast to coast. I'm Jim Blassingame, the Small Business Advocate. Dr. Robert McTeer is our guest. Bob is the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas and a member of the FOMC, the folks who set the interest rates. And we're going to talk about what happened when interest rates went down to 1.25. In just a minute, maybe he can blend that into the question I'm going to ask him now. Bob, is it safe to say that the Fed has never had the dynamics that it faces right now with regard to globalization, with regard to the challenges of our economy, with the changes in demographics, and with the war that seems to be imminent? Has the Fed? How far do we have to go back to get anything that even approaches the challenges that you guys are having right now?
Well, I don't know. There are a lot of challenges. I wouldn't say that everything on your list is a challenge in the sense of being negative, particularly the globalization part.
Right.
But I
didn't mean to say that it was negative, there are challenges whether negative or not.
Yeah, cross currents in the economy and makes it hard to read and hard to deal with sometimes.
Mm-hmm. What do we got to go back to? Maybe the 30s, early 30s, just before the Depression? To see this kind of extra degree of difficulty?
Well, maybe during the 30s, not necessarily before it. They thought they were dealing with it before it.
Mm-hmm.
they, they weren't doing too good a job, I guess.
What are the mistakes that they made then that exacerbated the recession? Didn't you write about that recently? It seems like
I don't think I did. Others tend to. Milton Friedman is the definitive word on that. He wrote this book with Anna Schwartz called The Monetary History of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
We got to remember that the economic theory and the tools of policy didn't exist then really to deal with a steep recession, depression situation. The basic mistake that was made was early in the 30s as banks failed and started wiping out people's money.
Right.
The Fed wasn't aggressive enough in coming in there and reliquefying and pumping up money.
Mm-hmm.
The gold was flowing out of the country, and that was allowed to shrink the money supply as it was supposed to. And we didn't have FDIC deposit insurance, so anytime there was a rumor of a weak bank, it tended to fail because of a run. And the multiple runs on banks extinguished a lot of money and purchasing power. And one of the biggest reforms during the 30s was deposit insurance, which basically, for most people, made it irrelevant whether their bank was sound or not. And the Fed, after Keynes wrote his General Theory of Employment, Interest, and Money that was published in 1936, everybody knew better that you ought to be expanding the money supply and so forth during a period of weakness. I think in the presidential election between Hoover and Roosevelt, they were both, for balancing the budget in the midst of all this. Well, you don't want to balance the budget then. You want the budget to be countercyclical. You want it to go against the weakness.
Mm-hmm. Well,
but everybody's learned a lot since then. I don't think we're going to do that again.
Well, and the thing is there were global issues in those days that nobody had ever really dealt with before, as you were indicating, and now you guys have.
Well, the Smoot-Hawley tariff is one of the big things that converted a recession into a worldwide depression.
Right.
Because we raised tariffs so we wouldn't import so much, and then people retaliated against us, and then we retaliated against the retaliators, and world trade just shrank, and so all the stimulus that was coming from everybody's exports and all the good stuff coming in from imports just sort of dried up.
Right. Talk to us about the surprising half point drop in interest rates in December. When you cut, cut rates from 1.75 to 1.25.
I believe it was November. You recall I dissented the meeting before that.
Yes, I do. I do recall that.
And but everybody saw the light. We knew that this fourth quarter was going to be very weak before it was generally known, I think. And when it's weakening rapidly, and you don't have a hell of a lot of ammunition left, you want to use it effectively. You don't just sit there and watch and wait. Of course, a lot of people say it didn't do it much good, but to say that, you've got to know what the alternative would have been.
Mm-hmm.
And up until the present day, construction and housing has been a mainstay of the economy, and that seems to have been one of the main beneficiaries of low interest rates.
Right. Well, I guess what I think what a lot of people predicted was that you might go a quarter, but a half it shocked a lot of people, didn't it? Why did it shock so many people?
Well, I don't know. I guess it's because for a lot of 2002, people were expecting us to start tightening, and here we were easing. So that difference right there, I guess, was viewed as fairly dramatic. So they figured it would just not be dramatic enough. But I think the Fed is. I tried to put it cleverly one day in an interview. I think it was pretty clever. I said the Fed has learned that medicine might be better in tablespoonfuls. Doses rather than teaspoons.
Yeah. Well, I think, as it turns out, I think you guys did the right thing, but it did surprise me. 29 after, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Dr. Robert McTeer, the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas. We're going to talk to him some more about what's going on in the economy. One of the things I want to ask him is, what's the difference between deflation and disinflation? Stay with us. We'll be right back.
He inspires small business.
We can teach these barbarians a lesson in Western methods and efficiency that will put them to shame.
He tells it like it is.
I realize how difficult it's going to be in this godforsaken place where you can't find what you need. And there's the challenge.
He's Jim Blassingay, the small business advocate.
With all due respect, sir, I believe this is going to be our finest hour.
Welcome back. It's 34 After. I'm Jim Blassingay, man. I'm glad you're here. 800-531-3815, toll-free coast-to-coast. My website is www.jbsba.com. Check it out when you get a chance. Dr. Robert McTeer is our guest, and he's the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas and a member of the Federal Open Market Committee. They're the folks who set the rates that you and I pay in a way, because banks charge us interest rates based on prime, and prime is typically 3 over the Fed funds rate, which is what the Fed set. Right now, Fed funds rate is at 1.25, right, Bob?
Yes.
And that makes prime 4.25, and that means that small business owners borrow money at 8 or 9%, because, Bob, we don't live in the world of prime. We live in the world of prime plus, small business owners, and so we know all about that. But the interest rates, Bob, right now, interest rates are not really what the problem is, is it? The cost of money is really not what our problem is it?
Well, it can be part of the cure. It's not really part of the problem. The recession is a profits and investment-led recession, and it's not just a matter of interest rates. It's a matter of business confidence and profitability and pricing power that they're worried about.
Right.
However, pushing rates as low as they've gone has helped the housing sector a lot through refinancings, and it's helped consumption spending generally a lot, because people have been getting equity out of their houses, which is not necessarily a good idea individually, but
right.
Collectively it's been supporting the economy. If you don't mind my source being the TV, I can give you some numbers that are just
I'd like to go ahead.
Screen.
Go ahead.
They're just this morning announcing the unemployment numbers for January, and non-farm jobs are up 143,000.
For the month of January.
For the month of January. This compares to being down 101,000 in December, and they've revised that down to be down 156. So December was worse than originally indicated, and January is a significant improvement.
Yeah.
And it looks as though, I've got the thing on mute, but it looks as though the unemployment rate, which was 6%, has dropped back down to 5.7.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's good news, and this situation, this unemployment situation, is going to take a while to solve, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because of redeployment. I mean, we've got to reorient workers. We can't. These people aren't. Many people in America are not going back to the same jobs that they left.
That's one way you get the needed downward wage flexibility. People won't take pay cuts, so they end up having to change jobs where they get a lower salary.
Mm-hmm.
If the markets were flexible enough for people to be more willing to adjust their salaries downward, there'd be less need to have to move to have that happen.
What's the biggest, let's change subjects just a little bit, and let me ask you this question. What's the biggest threat, inflation or deflation?
Well, at the moment, I think they're fairly well balanced, and I don't think we're on the verge of either right now. I don't think we're on the verge of inflation building up dramatically, because we do have a lot of slack in the economy, because it's been weak for a couple of years now.
Profits, I mean, inventories are under control.
Inventories are under control, yeah.
You mentioned the wage flexibility.
Yeah, and the productivity growth that helps you avoid inflation, because it means that you can have higher wages without having higher unit labor costs.
Right.
On the other side of the coin, deflation, which is falling prices, generally across the board. People have been worried about that because inflation rate has gotten so low. But lately, the price of commodities, especially including gold, is sending signals that there's liquidity in the world economy, and people that have been worried about that are not quite so worried right now.
Right.
I saw our friend Larry Kudlow on the screen just a moment ago. He thinks that rise in the price of gold is a wonderful thing, because it means the Fed's not too tight.
Yeah.
Others traditionally take a rise in the price of gold to mean that maybe the Fed's too easy.
What do you think?
Well, I think it's just right.
Yeah. Like Goldilocks. What about, what's the difference in deflation and disinflation?
Well, disinflation just means the rate of inflation is coming down. The prices are still rising, but they're rising more slowly.
Right.
Deflation means that prices are actually falling. We actually have had deflation this past year in the goods sector of the economy. It's just been more than offset in services.
We've had good deflation. Yeah.
Good. Yeah, I have the S on that.
We have. Yeah, we have. We have talked about that on the show before with our deflation expert Gary Schilling.
Oh, okay. You mean you meant what you said then?
Yes, I did. No, I thought
that was a slip.
No, I certainly did. There is such a thing as good deflation. It's when you're the $500 cell phone you bought 10 years ago now costs $25. That's good deflation. 22. We'll be right back. Stay with us. We're back at 17 till. Let me remind you, coming up in the show straight ahead, how many of you have ever read the book The Road Less Traveled by M. Scott Peck? 20 years ago, that book contributed to changing my life. That was the book where Scott Peck said that everybody in the world, all human beings, can be put into two different groups, people who take responsibility for themselves and people who don't. And I believe that. And he's going to be on the show. They're relaunching his book, reissuing his book after it's a 25-year anniversary of that very important book. There's no telling how many millions of copies of that book is sold. But Scott Peck will be on this show on Monday. I'm looking forward to that. And then after that, Karen Post is going to talk to us about branding, and Sam Norwood with the Tatum CFO Partners is going to tell us what the small business folks and the movers and shakers in the marketplace said the economy did last month. Bob McTeer is our guest. He's the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas. Bob, I want to talk a little bit more about productivity. Here's a quote from the article that was in the Wall Street Journal that you authored about a month ago. You said productivity growth is what raises our living standards.
Mm-hmm.
And now, do you remember the quote? I don't remember who it was. It was either Lenin or Marx. I've forgotten who it is attributed to. But and I'm paraphrasing the quote. It was something like, capitalism will be its own undoing. Have we gotten so productive? Are we getting so productive that we're seeing our own undoing?
No. Productivity growth is a good thing. It's not a bad thing. Some people.
But can you see how people would? How some people might be looking at it now and saying that if you've got this kind of growth and yet you've got this kind of unemployment, this kind of productivity.
Well, I got an irate letter. I got more than one letter, but I got a letter as a result of that article from this guy who focused on my joke in that article. My joke was the factor of the future have to be a man and a dog.
Yeah, I love that. tell the audience what...
the way things are going now, the factor of the future will have only a man and a dog. The man is there to feed the dog. And the dog's there to keep the man from touching the computer. And
that's a great story.
This letter writer, insisted on treating that seriously, and he asked me, "Who's going to be buying the products of that factory?"
Yeah, that's a good question.
Since there are no workers, and that's sort of the where you were. It's sort of the way you were thinking just now.
Yeah.
Well. It's sort of a truism that whenever you produce and sell output, it generates enough income to buy that output back. Mm-hmm. And in an accounting sense, the expenditure and the income in that process are identical. Now, it could be possible that the way the income is distributed might mean that it won't all get spent. And it may be that if the income distribution gets really, really skewed, we would have an underconsumption problem. But the statistics show that the share of income going to labor, going to capital, going to profits is reasonably constant in this country over time. So I don't think we have to worry about that.
Okay,
on globalization, we're losing a lot of jobs, mm-hmm. and we're creating a lot of jobs. The jobs we're losing to low-wage countries.
Forever.
Yeah, probably. So it's up to us. Keep upgrading our skills.
That's right.
And our value added.
That's what we've got to do, and that's the challenge, though. I think we've got that's the convergence of challenges that I was alluding to earlier in the hour, and we've got a lot of folks out there that are never going to go back to the job that they lost. They'll never do that profession again, and so we've got some challenges there, and I don't know that I see a lot of people addressing that issue. Do you, Bob? Do you see the government or the industries doing that?
I think if people were being more rational about it, there'd be a lot more serious students in continuing education classes and
right.
training classes. Education's a lifelong thing now, not just something you get in the first few years of your life.
That's right. That's right. You've always got to keep learning. That's exactly right. Bob, let's talk about the Fed for a minute. Is there a plan for life after Alan, after Mr. Greenspan retires? I get irritated when people say Alan Greenspan did this, you know, when it was really the Fed. Alan Greenspan did that when it was really the Fed. And I hear smart people saying that, personifying the Fed through Alan Greenspan. And I know he has a lot of influence, but he's not the only guy up there.
Well, he's first among equals, and he's
yep.
really good. And we will miss him if he ever leaves.
But what's the plan for life after Alan?
Well, I don't think there's a memo that's been locked in his desk drawer with a note that says, Greenspan successor, please open this envelope.
Yeah.
Alan Greenspan, as good as he is, he's good because his judgment is good. He's good because he has a real good feel for the economy, because he spent a lifetime reading the tea leaves. But what he does is not unique. I mean, a lot of people are trained to do those same things. He may be the best, but he's mm-hmm. not the only.
And, opinion of him went up even more than it already was about a year ago. I found out he was a disciple of Ayn Rand.
Oh yeah.
I didn't know that until fairly recently.
I'll tell you a story about that.
Okay. I tell you what, we got about 30 seconds. Is that enough time, or you need to wait till we come back?
Yeah, I can do it.
Okay.
A friend of mine used to teach a high school class based on Atlas Shrugged, Ayn Rand's book,
mm-hmm.
and I introduced her to Greenspan one night at a function.
Wow.
And I told him that, and he said, well, I read that book when it was in its galley proofs.
Oh, yeah, what a story. Golly. Folks, there's a book that, there's a little paperback called Capitalism, The Unknown Ideal by Ayn Rand, and it's a collection of articles. Some of them are authored by Alan Greenspan, so check that out. And they're still available wherever books are sold. Tim Till, right back with Bob McTeer. Stay with us. We're back at 7 till. Got a lot of stuff still to cover with our good friend Dr. Robert McTeer, president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas. Folks, I want you to go to this website, dallasfed.org. It's not your grandfather's Federal Reserve website, folks. This is a cool website, I promise you, dallasfed.org. Get your name in the hat for a free copy of their annual report. It's on free trade this time, isn't it, Bob?
Yeah, the one coming up is. It'll uh-huh. be a couple of months before that makes it
right.
out.
But you still got time. You can still get a copy of last year's, which, as I'm trying to remember, was it on labor? What was it on?
Last year's had to do with the resilience of the U.S. economy.
That's it. Okay, and you can get a free copy of that, folks, by telling them on the website there that you want it. This is not, and folks, this is an important document. I have benefited from this annual report by the Dallas Fed in my own business, so I recommend it to you. And congratulate Bob and Mike Cox, who's also a friend of ours, and for all the hard work that they do on that. Bob, we've got two or three things I want to cover real quickly. What about the 2003 economy? How's it going to look?
Well, forecasting is a very hazardous business. I don't see any real reason it shouldn't look reasonably good, though. Monetary policy is got a lot of oomph in it right now, and fiscal policy is moving toward expansion. So
they're trying, aren't they?
Both those are tailwinds,
mm-hmm.
and there's some signs that manufacturing is coming back to life, not in the telecom sector, but others.
But IT is predicting a good second half, though. All my friends in IT are predicting a good second half.
Yeah, and it's beginning to show up, too, and some of the statistics, but
yeah.
not the communications industry yet.
But after a while, people are going to have to start spending, because the stuff that they've been working with and not spending money on is wearing out. It's becoming obsolete. And here's another thing that's interesting, Bob. Even companies that are not making a lot of money have got a lot of cash right now.
Yeah.
What are we going to do with it? What are they going to do with all that cash?
Well, I sure hope they put some of it in the stock market.
Don't you think that bodes well? The pent up demand for capital items and all that cash. Don't you think that bodes well for an expansion?
I think so. I don't expect it to be gangbusters.
No, I don't. It doesn't need to be gangbusters, does it?
Can I give you just an observation about how far we've come into this high-tech internet economy?
Yes, sir.
When you used to tout our website, you would start with www.
Uh-huh.
You've dropped that.
That's right. It's not necessary.
Because you know that everybody out there knows to add the W.
You're exactly right. No, that's exactly right. I've quit doing that, and some occasionally I'll do that. But you'll notice that more and more people are doing that. That's a good observation. Bob, let's talk for just a minute about demographics. I saw something the other day. Something like, I think it's 3 out of 4 of every human being who's ever reached the age of 65. 3 out of 4 of them are alive today. What's that going to mean for our culture in the future?
Larger fonts.
Larger fonts. big screens and big fonts. And extra light, too.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, you know, I don't know exactly what to say in answer to that. I know that the other day my wife was reading me the ad on an assisted living complex.
Yeah.
It used to be that you'd read other kinds of ads. Now, now we're beginning to think in that direction.
Well,
on the broader picture of population, you know, the U.S. is one of the few major areas lately that's been gaining population.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Europe's dropping, isn't it?
A lot of parts of the world is dropping. We're not, and part of the reason we're not is we allow immigration, which keeps us vital and dynamic.
Yeah.
So that's just another reason to be pro-immigration.
But with baby boomers aging, the marketplace is going to change. The pressures on our infrastructure is changing significantly, isn't it?
Yeah. And we don't have to plan that, you know, because we have a free economy. And,
right.
And these adjustments just get made automatically.
But these are challenges and opportunities that we need to be looking at. When I saw that statistic, that just blew me away. And anyway, Bob, thank you for being here. Any last thoughts before you go?
No. Have a good day to you and all your listeners.
I appreciate it. Bob McTeer, ladies and gentlemen, who Jim Blasingame, Larry Kudlow, probably the Wall Street Journal, and many other people, smart people too, by the way, think should be the next Federal Reserve Chairman. I know I certainly do. I know Larry Kudlow does, because he's already published that. And we'll look forward to that. Bob, thank you for being here.
So we're ending this show on irrational exuberance.
I think so.
Okay, thanks, Jim.
Maybe not. Thanks, Bob. I got to go for this hour. Before I do, I told you we'd have fun when Bob joined us. Small business owners, you know you're my heroes. And also every member of our military, wherever you are standing a post around the world on our behalf, God bless you. God be with you. We are so proud of you. You are our heroes. This is Jim Blasingame, the Small Business Advocate, and this program is for you.
Insperity presents the Small Business Advocate Show with Jim Blasingame. This is a copyrighted production of Small Business Network, Inc., intended for the private use of our audience. Except as otherwise provided by copyright law, all other copying, redistribution, or publication without prior written consent is prohibited. All rights reserved.